Good morning, everyone. How are you all doing? So, today I'm going to talk, as Catherine said, about how to escape a World War II prisoner of war camp. And this is very much one of those special interests that got out of hand, where I just ended up reading far too many books about the subject. And we're talking about quite a narrow range of experience here. This is mostly RAF people between Dunkirk and D-Day. What I'm going to try and do is produce five simple rules that will be helpful if you ever find yourself in this ahistorical situation. So the first thing to say is that most of the people who ended up in prisoner of war camps in the bulk of the war were RAF aircrew. And what would happen is that they would start the day in the UK, have a breakfast, maybe spend some time, you know, relaxing in the afternoon, and then during the evening, they'd have to climb into a plane filled with high explosive, fly all the way to Germany while people were shooting at them, and then fly all the way back. And this was incredibly dangerous. It was common for 10% of the planes on a mission not to come back. And you'd probably not rehearsed bailing out of a plane. So the first time you're doing it is for real. And you land on the ground knowing that the locals may be hunting for you because they've been told about the terror flyers. So for a lot of people, by the time they got picked up by the local authorities, it was a relief when somebody said, and they actually said this, "For you, the war is over." The thing is that this is probably the best situation, the closest to freedom you might be for years. So a lot of people, you know, never kind of always regretted not taking advantage of the fact that, you know, the security among local police was a lot less than they were going to encounter when they were handed over to the Luftwaffe, where they went to an interrogation camp initially, where you got to send a letter home, you got processed, and they tried to persuade you to give up all the information about your colleagues back in the UK. And after this, you'd be channeled back into the camp system, and then it'd be very, very hard to get out. One thing to say is that towards the end of the war, there was these incredibly efficient escape lines set up, which would find the people who'd landed and spirit them back into Allied lines. And it was common for half the flyers towards the end of the war, after D-Day, to be back on active duty within a couple of days. Now, obviously, war is an incredibly unpleasant thing. So the stories I'm telling here are kind of a light-hearted aspect, but yeah, there's a lot of different stories to be told about prisoners of war, and we're doing it, again, very narrow set of experiences. And during this period of World War II, the Americans and the British had a lot of German prisoners. There was a kind of reciprocal thing of wanting to take care of each other's side. There was also the Luftwaffe were keeping to the Geneva Convention. And the Geneva Convention said it's the duty of a prisoner to try to escape. And if you were caught, the worst that could be done was 30 days in solitary. And for a lot of people, 30 days in solitary was a bit of a relief after being crammed in with lots of people. And this situation lasted until the Great Escape, when the Germans executed 50 of the people involved in that, and that was the end of the kind of classic era of escape. In fact, MI9, the Secret Service devoted to escape and invasion, sent out a message through covert channels that all escape should cease. And generally, the British would make every single air crew member an officer so that they couldn't be forced to work. The downside of this was that, you know, life was full of boredom. There was not very much to do. So some people turned to studying for degrees, some wasted time playing cards, and others decided they were going to escape. And the camp you'd find yourself in would generally be a series of compounds, with the outer wall being two fences of barbed wire, with lots of barbed wire in between. The camp would be brightly lit, there'd be searchlights and guard towers, there'd be dogs roaming free at night, there'd be specially trained officers called ferrets, whose job was to stop people escaping. There was also microphones placed under the ground to listen for attempts at tunnelling. And you'd have roll calls twice a day to make sure that the count was correct. And it's worth noting that the guards here weren't necessarily the best trained guards. There's one case of somebody, Maitresse Lebrun, who was in Colditz, who got his friend to vault him over a wire fence, and then he ran back and forth along the outside fence of Colditz, with the guards shooting at him, waiting until they'd run out of ammo, because he'd kind of guessed that they probably wouldn't be able to hit him if he kept moving. Rather cheekily, he'd left a load of his baggage wrapped up in his room with a note asking the commandant to send it onto his family if he got away. So, rule two, you have to make the decision to escape. And one of the things that doesn't come across in a lot of the movies about escape is that a lot of people weren't really very excited about the idea of escaping. They'd done their bit. It was so much safer being in a camp than being aircrew. I think at one point, only one in six people would survive a full 30-flight tour. A lot of people saw escaping as a form of exhibitionism, showing off. It was wasting time. There was also a fear that people might have their privileges revoked if an escape attempt was caught. So there's actually cases of some escape attempts being betrayed by people among the British prisoners. It's also fair to say that Colditz is given as the classic example of escape. But for a lot of people, they were forced to work all day, they didn't have the energy or the language knowledge to escape. So for a lot of people, a lot of prisoners were quite resentful of this idea that everyone was trying to escape and everyone nearly made it. And a lot of them, like I say, were quite content to see out the war. And, you know, people did manage to find their entertainments. This is Ballet Nonsense, the 1941 Colditz Christmas show. So, yeah, one of the classic escapers, Wings Day, he said that only about 5% of people really wanted to escape. But a lot of people would try and help out. And it was a good way of making the days go faster. Rule three, collaborate and cooperate. So every failed attempt is going to make future attempts harder. So if you basically spot an opportunity, take it, and get caught, that's gone for everyone. So the camp started organising escape committees. And if you wanted to escape, you first had to come up with your plan and then pitch it to the escape committee. This was a little bit like Dragon's Den, but for escaping. But if they liked the plan, then they'd invest in it. And you could get a huge number of people helping. You could pool resources for food, so people would save bits of rations, so that you had supplies to make the journey. You would also handle things like bribery. So finding out which officers were vulnerable, bribing them, asking to borrow their passes so you could make copies and so on. And you'd also have the escape committee in contact with MI9, the secret service related to escape, who would sometimes send in maps and so on to the camp. So here's an example of hiding German money within a set of records. Famously at one camp, when they discovered this, they went and then broke every single record they had, just in case there was more, and discovered there wasn't quite as much as they'd hoped. The other thing you need to do is keep an eye on who's inside the compound. And there was these incredibly elaborate schemes for watching for the ferrets if they were getting too close. Now, you couldn't obviously just run straight into the barracks and go, hey guys, hide everything, because it'd be obvious that that was where things were. So you'd have little signals, like there'd be somebody sat on a chair, and if they stood up from the chair, it meant that somebody had come into the compound, so it was time to start hiding everything away. The British also kept really good logs of who was coming in and out of the camps. So good that some of the Germans actually took to signing themselves in sarcastically. And there's even a case in one camp where the commandant was convinced that not everyone was doing their duties, so asked the British if he could borrow the logs to double check against the rotors. The other thing the British used to do was goon baiting. They put a lot of time and effort just into being incredibly annoying. And, you know, these were people that had been at boarding school, etc. So they were kind of treating the whole thing a bit like they're still at boarding school. So they would tease the German officers, they would constantly shuffle around, they would stare at their trousers until the German officers checked their flies. Anything just to keep them slightly uncertain and slightly confused. Even setting up, when one of the senior Germans came to visit a camp, a set of Australians did a pretend machine gun set up. And can anyone spot what's wrong with this picture? So, this is Max. Now the idea of Max was that he was a dummy. There was two dummies that were owned by the Dutch in Colditz. The idea being that when they counted the number of people in the roll call, they'd miscount it. So what you could do is you could set up what was called a ghost. So what you do is you'd hide somebody in the camp and they wouldn't turn up for roll call, which meant that the count was out by one. So you know, you could do it by maybe a dummy, or you could just hide somebody. If they could avoid being caught when the hue and cry went up, when somebody else later escaped, you'd bring that person back into circulation and the count would still be the same, giving more time for somebody to get away. And you know, there's incredible hardship of people who would hide for months, you know, in small confined spaces just so that the Germans wouldn't actually find them and they could help somebody else escape. So, tip number four, there are three ways out: over, under, or through. And that was actually how the escape committee set itself up as three different groups. And tunnels are incredibly hard work. They take a huge amount of labour, they're quite dangerous. They also mean that you can, you're not going to be shot at as you try and get out the camp. You also have an 8-hour head start on anyone looking for you. So effectively, you get out straight off, as soon after roll call as you can, start running, you've got 8 hours before anyone notices you're missing. And even better, if they're not discovered afterwards, you can reuse them. And these things were incredibly involved. I mean, this is a picture of the entrance to one of the great escape tunnels. You can see it's been made with bed slats that people used to donate their slats from their bed to be used for shoring up tunnels and so on. And it, you know, a lot of people would record sort of falling through their beds because they got rid of so many of the slats. But again, it's this idea of cooperation that, you know, the camp can work together. And yeah, the classic, the Great Escape was the classic World War II escape. So you had hundreds of people all working together with the idea that they were going to make civilian costumes for 200 people, documents and passes, and then basically get them all out on the same night. There's incredible forgeries made. These took incredible work because the German pens were very, very poor. So people used to make these with watercolours. And there were three tunnels built for the Great Escape: Tom, Dick and Harry. The idea being that building one tunnel, you'd expect that. There's no way anyone would predict that they would make three tunnels at the same time. So if they found one, they'd assume that they'd got everything. This also meant that one of the tunnels could then be used to hide waste later on. And yeah, this is an incredible amount of work. There were sort of tracks to help move the soil back and forth. There were air tubes made out of tin cans that had been sent in the Red Cross parcels. And there's even air bellows just to keep the air fresh for the people working at the front of the tunnel. You also had to dispose of the soil. So this is what was known as the penguins. So you'd wear these little bags inside your trousers, and while you were sort of strolling around the camp, you could let little bits of soil off so that there wasn't a huge heap of spoil that would give away the fact that somebody was building a tunnel. And the Great Escape was incredible. I mean, 77 people made it out on that one single night, of whom three made it to freedom. So again, the odds against this are huge, but everyone put the work in. And yeah, this was the attempt where Hitler was so furious at it happening that 50 of the escapers were executed, and that's what brought an end to the classic era of escape. So the tunnels in the Great Escape were 300 meters long, which is an incredible amount of work. So what would be even easier is maybe if you could start them from the middle of the parade ground. And that was the idea of the wooden horse escape. So the British built a vaulting horse and started spending a couple of hours every day leaping over this vaulting horse. And the Germans were sort of very pleased that the British were spending their time usefully getting exercise. What they'd actually done was hidden two people inside this vaulting horse. They would carry it to the centre of the parade ground where there was a sort of trap door with soil hidden on top of it. They'd lift that out and they were starting to build a tunnel directly below the parade ground. Now, when I read about this, I'm just blown away by how much just work went into this. So when they carried the wooden horse out into the parade ground, there's two people in there, and on the way back, there's also a load of soil, but you've got to pretend that it's just really easy to carry. And then everyone's going to spend 2 or 3 hours exercising in order to cover for this, because if people are running and making noise, it'll confuse the microphones. So again, an incredible amount of work going into just getting three people out of the camp. But this was a successful one and sent three people home. Getting through the fence, obviously you can't just cut through. Unless, for example, the snow or very thick fog, it's going to take too long for you to cut through all the wire, and you're probably going to get caught halfway. However, every camp has a front door, and if you can sort of make use of that, you'll get out. So a lot of people would do things like they would hide in the rubbish trucks. There's one guy who made himself a suit with loads of tin cans attached so he could hide in the rubbish. He got caught because they discovered at the last minute the Germans started putting spears into the rubbish, and they had to call that attempt off. There was amazing work making disguises. So one thing to say is that the Germans were incredibly good at documenting the escapes because they wanted to be able to train all the officers, which means we've got these wonderful pictures of the attempts to escape. And people would make Nazi uniforms covertly. They'd make fake guns that looked good enough to pass as the real thing, and then sort of bluff themselves past the people at the doors. This is another person, Michael Sinclair, who disguised himself as a senior officer. The idea being that he would dismiss all the guards at the sentry points, and then just run out freely. He very nearly made this, apart from his pass wasn't quite correct, and ended up getting shot by one of the sentries, who was incredibly disturbed, because even as he fired, he wasn't sure if it was the officer or not. Another escape, somebody dressed as a woman to leave Colditz, and apparently almost made it, apart from the fact their watch strap broke, and that was enough to kind of make the Germans consider, why is, you know, this is a men-only camp, how come somebody's leaving? And obviously, you know, the walkouts are much easier early on. Here's somebody disguised as a Polish chimney sweep, and again, waiting for him to come into the camp, and then you'd wander out dressed as this person. And yeah, there's some great stories, and one of the things about like researching something like this is that not all the stories you kind of find them hinted at. It's like, is that really true? And one of my favourite stories is of a Polish naval officer who disguised himself as a civilian, walked into the guard room with a suitcase, and said that he'd come to visit his brother and demanded to be let into the camp by the Germans. The Germans were furious at this and pointed out that you can't just wander into a camp to visit people, and told him to leave and escorted him off the premises. The one story I really wish I could find out if it's true was two people who disguised themselves as workmen, and they found a tin of white paint and allegedly started drawing a white line through the camp. And when they got to the gate, kind of waved, the gate was open, they carried on drawing their white line until they got to the corner, and then once they got to the corner, ran for it. So Wings Day tells that story. I wish it was true, but I can't find any kind of proof of that fact. Another unsuccessful attempt, disguising yourself as a blanket of leaves. So this was sort of taken down to the parade ground, the exercise ground at Colditz. People hid underneath it, and then basically, when the Germans took everyone back to the castle, they tried to scarper. Sadly, they were caught by the dogs. And another easy thing is basically, if you're being taken out for medical care, it's much easier to escape from a hospital. So if you were competent enough to fake appendicitis, you could basically get out that way. But it's always, the thing to say is that it's always easier at the start. The more attempts fail, the harder it's going to get. The third way out is climbing over the fence. And this, people reckon this took about 15 minutes to do. And so it's incredibly dangerous. And you only do it if there's a snowstorm or something. Apparently there was one person who managed to bluff his way over by disguising himself as a ferret, fixing a seismograph, then dropping his pliers through the fence, and then sort of going round, picking them up, going off for coffee and escaping. So again, that kind of idea of bluff. But one of the great attempts at escape is the Warburg wire job. So this was an attempt by the British to get 40 people out of a camp. And they built these elaborate ladders with a hinge in the middle. The idea being that they could run up to the fence, flip the top of the ladder over, it would make a walkway across the barbed wire. And the British trained for ages at this. They'd they used the ladders for music room shelves, and they could do just enough practice in between German patrols to start learning how to get across this thing. And on the night, they fused all the electricity, and yeah, I think 27 people got over the fence, and three made it all the way home with only a few minor injuries. So again, this incredible preparation to do escapes. Rule 5, staying free is the hardest part. So there are estimates that in Colditz, 316 men are recorded as attempting 174 escapes, but only 32 made it all the way back home. So the odds against escaping are incredibly hard. It's one thing to get over the walls, but these camps were placed deep in enemy territory. So it's a long way to try and find a ship or something else that can carry you into neutral or allied territory. And, you had to make the choice of, do you want to travel by train, which is going to be faster? But then you'd have to have civilian clothes. You'd have to pass as either a guest worker or a German. And you'd also have to have up-to-date passes. So traveling on train, incredibly efficient, got you a long way, but very risky. Or do you travel by night? Now, traveling by night, there's not a lot of time. There's dogs barking, it's cold. Where do you kind of hide during the day? Because if you hide in a barn, you like to get caught. So it took a lot of work to try and get out of Germany. You're also reliant on very old information about how to escape. So, you had to ask other people who tried, where did they get caught, and slowly build up an idea among yourselves. It's incredibly, incredibly difficult. But the big question is, was it worth it trying to escape? So, as I said, the odds against this were incredibly hard. But, it upset the enemy. It damaged morale. So it was considered to be help with the war effort. And the decision to escape was said to be revitalizing. So even though I think it's reckoned that less than 0.15% of people managed to escape, and less than half of that made it all the way home, it was still worth doing. MI9 estimated that the average time out was 5 days. But they said, even if recaptured, prisoners have had a good deal of fun and excitement, and their punishment is a maximum of 30 days. And the prisoners often felt that these few moments of freedom were worth the drudgery and hard work. And to some prisoners, a few days' freedom were worth the effort of years. And I'd just like to end with what I think is the most incredible escape attempt of World War II. This is the Colditz Cog. So each of the camps had a library where, there'd be various books that you could study. A lot of people passed qualifications and did university degrees from the camps. And one day, two people realized there was a book on aeronautics in the camp, which described how to make a plane. And they did the calculations. They reckoned that they could build a glider inside Colditz, using kind of odds and ends, so bed boards, bucket handles, hinges and door fittings. And they made this glider in the roof. The idea being was that towards the end of the war, there was a very big fear that the SS were going to take control of Colditz and kill all the prisoners. So this glider was built with the idea of flying over the enemy lines to try and get to the Americans and get them to come in and rescue the castle. And the idea was going to be that there was going to be a bathtub full of rubble that would be dropped from as high a point as possible that would then flick this glider out. And the glider was never needed in the end and went missing. There's only this photograph taken by an American as a trace of it. But there have been people who've actually then gone on to build replicas of this glider and prove that, yes, it would have flown. And like I say, I think it's just an incredible testament to what people can do if they've got sufficient spare time and a desperate desire to get home. Thank you very much.